You're listening to The Dead Prussian, a podcast about war and warfare.
We've talked about using fiction on the show before. We've talked about exploring modern day experiences of the Pentagon using fiction quite recently. We've talked about drawing on popular culture and fiction to highlight lessons in modern conflict. And we've also talked about fiction intelligence, or hashtag ficint, from episodes we've done with August Cole. Now, how else can you generate fiction that helps understand the future of conflict? There's writers, there's creatives, there's people who think about this stuff, but sometimes it helps to write it or read it from the people that may have to fight it. That actually rhymed more than I expected. A little bit of alliteration there too. G'day listeners, and welcome to the Dead Prussian podcast. Without a doubt, the greatest podcast on the internet, named after a 19th century Prussian military theorist. And I am your host, Mick, and thank you very much to our legends, our Patreon supporters. You are absolute legends, one and all. You have been supporting the show for a while now, and we appreciate it. Also, those people who've been dropping some iTunes reviews, thanks very much for that. That is great. Those people who like to drop us five-star reviews and all the positive comments, that's even better. And you know what? Those five-star reviews that have some critique in them as well, thanks for the five-star reviews. I'll ignore the critique, but I'll take the stars. Anyone else who doesn't want to drop us any more than, anyone who doesn't want to drop us four stars and above, feel free not to leave a review. Why? Because we're selfish. Now, listeners, I talked a little bit about fiction and fiction intelligence before, but there's been this really interesting thing happening lately from a lot of military-focused centers, blogs, schools, institutes, and one of them has actually paired up with us in a very limited way. We're providing a very, very limited amount of support in the sense that we just want to know the final outcome. But one of these centers has run a creative writing contest focusing on a very specific topic of future conflict. And they enabled us, or they allowed us more importantly, to speak to the competition winner and read the story. Yeah, that's right. I had a preview of the story long before you all read it. Now, the place that did this was the Krulak Center, and it was the Krulak Center's creative writing contest that was sponsored by the Marine Corps University Foundation. The title of this contest is The Marine Corps Postmortem. Sounds a bit grisly, actually. And it was open to any student, resident or non-resident at the Marine Corps University. So my guest today is the winner of that competition, a Marine who was able to write about how they see the end of the US Marine Corps in the future and the reasoning behind the end of the US Marine Corps. It sounds a bit pessimistic, but I guess it's a way of using fiction to write about mistakes that could be avoided. Now, my guest today is an artillery officer by training, so I think he's an absolute legend, obvious reasons why that is, and it is Major Timothy Heck. Now, Tim is a brigade platoon commander at the 6th Air Naval Gunfire Liaison Company Marine Forces Reserve. So he's an Anglico dude, which is pretty cool. Now, his writing can be found in the Journal of Slavic Military Studies, which I know I've probably got about 1,000 listeners out there who are subscribers to that journal. The Michigan War Studies Review, it does more than muscle cars. The Strategy Bridge, a few people have heard of that one. And the Journal of Military History, among others. He's currently working on several projects on the Red Army during and after the Great Patriotic War. He's also a freelance editor focusing on military history and national security related projects. And he's currently working on a volume that we're pretty excited about on amphibious operations. And that is with Brett Friedman, who you will know not from any of the great work he's done, but obviously you'll know him from his interview on this show. Tim, thanks for coming on the show.
Mick, thanks for having me.
Now, Tim, before we start discussing your story, and we'll discuss that pretty soon, but I'm keen to find out how you got interested in creative writing to explore future war.
You let off in my self-aggrandized biography. Thank you for that, by the way. Talking about, you know, that I do a lot of work on the Soviets. I'm focused on what they call what the Russians call the Great Patriotic War, and what the Soviets did as well, World War II to the rest of the world. And, you know, that's a relatively, probably, you know, that's the last 5 years of my work. But I grew up reading this stuff, right? I grew up reading Vonnegut, Slaughterhouse-Five, and Norman Mailer's The Quick and the Dead, and Joseph Heller's Catch-22. And, you know, here are, you know, warriors, soldiers, airmen of the past trying to make sense of their experience as participants in this you know, cataclysmic event that was the Second World War. And so growing up, having read that, and you know, I read Catch-22 in high school on my own, and then read it again in Iraq when I was there in 2007, which was a kind of an odd juxtaposition to be reading about that and looking around and going, huh, who's major around here? Mm-hmm. And what, you know, what is our Catch-22 about all of this? But I think having grown up in that and being from Indianapolis, where Kurt Vonnegut's from, right? Like, he's the dean of literature coming out of of my hometown, and making sense of Billy Pilgrim in Dresden. And I use him a lot when I'm explaining what war means and what it does. I met my wife after the wars, after Iraq and Afghanistan, and used Vonnegut's concept of being unstuck in time to explain to her, like, the idea that, you know, I mean, as of a few days from now, it'll be 10 years since I've been in Afghanistan, and it feels like yesterday, and it feels like a million years ago. And so having that background literarily in fiction, and, you know, reading it obsessively, turned around and I went, what does it mean for the future? I saw the prompt on Twitter. I was, you know, working on upping my Twitter game, trying to get my name out there as an editor, as a writer, to drum up some more business. And I saw the prompt. The Krulak Center is a relatively new thing to me for the Marine Corps, right? I've been to a bunch of Marine Corps university schools at this point, 17 years into my career. So knew what MCU does, had no clue, and still trying to figure out somewhat what the Krulak Center does. I actually was the operations officer there, or the executive director there, was the fire support coordinator for Regimental Combat Team 5 in Iraq, or yeah, RCT 5 when we were in Iraq. So I met with him every week, and to see his name on this was, oh, I know you. But I saw the prompt and I thought, well, that's interesting. You know, I like the premise that the Marine Corps was in some way asking about its fate, right? You know, we in 2007, all the Marines were tasked with reading Krulak's book, First to Fight, which, if you need something to sleep on a plane and you can't get audio of John Kerry's speeches, you should go for that. But the premise behind First to Fight is this idea that, you know, one of the key takeaways that I walked out of there with was, you know, everybody's trying to shut the Marine Corps down, and America doesn't need a Marine Corps. America wants a Marine Corps. And I think there's a lot of validity to that second thesis. The first thesis, that everybody's trying to shut us down, tends to build a little bit of a bunker mentality. But the idea that Marine Corps University was asking Marines to think about what life would be like without a Marine Corps, in an institutional sense, was pretty cool. And so, you know, combined, I saw that, made me think about my own experiences. I think later is probably the time to tell you about Portugal. But at the same time that prompt comes out, I'm looking around and I'm watching America's decline relative in the world, and going, you know, there's no guarantee that, one, the Marine Corps exists, two, that America remains the world's, you know, hegemon, and three, that America remains what it looks like today. I'm 17 years into my career at this point, and my wife and I are talking about retirement and what that looks like for us on a personal level. You know, we all get out of the Marine Corps at some point. But that's, you know, that was one of the themes that I explored in the story, was the commandant, you know, and jumping ahead again, but the, you know, it's a personal story about one man's experience as the Marine Corps comes to an end. And that's where I went with it. But in terms of thic int and that sort of stuff, it was certainly not my intent, but I'm glad to be lumped in with it.
And now that you've given us a few spoilers, spoiler alert, listeners, what the story is about. It's cool. This is why I shouldn't even bother sending run sheets to guests, listeners. They just they always jump ahead. You're not the worst I've had, Tim, but you're on a warning. Now your story, Alphas, which is the name of your story, it's one thing you didn't give away. Now that focuses on the last day of the U.S. Marine Corps, post a major power conflict. Now, can you give our listeners an overview of your story?
Yeah, it's it is the Commandant of the Marine Corps in his house at 8th and I in Washington, D.C., walking downstairs from his bedroom, past his memories, both professional and personal, to go outside for a final ceremony in which he turns the colors of the Marine Corps over to the Secretary of the Navy. Executes an about face, and that's the end of the Marine Corps. And it focuses on his, what I would imagine his reflections would be, as we would have to do something like this in 25 years, possibly.
And that's a pretty succinct version of the story, ladies and gents. It's a very short story, so make sure you get along to Kulak Center and read it, because it has some pretty punchy themes in there. And I don't mean punchy as in Sylvester Stallone after the fifth Rocky movie. I mean punchy as in hard hitting. Now, loss seems to be a significant theme in your story. It's one of those ones that really hits you. And it's not just terms in terms of like military defeat. But what I'm talking about is, you know, this story has personal loss, institutional loss, something hitting a national psyche. Now, why did you focus on loss in this way?
I'm not going to blame. Blame's the wrong word, but my wife had something to do with this, and she didn't even know I was writing this. But we've been having a lot of talks about identities, and you know what my identity is. You know, I'm, as you said at the beginning, I'm a reservist. You know, the traditional, I'm a Chaco in Aussie terms, but you know, the idea of one weekend a month, 2 weeks a year isn't valid. It isn't. It isn't my reality as a reservist. You know, I am spending time and energy and mental firepower, what I have of it, to support this identity. And you know, I've gone through a couple of career changes since leaving active duty. I was a federal agent. I did school operations at an international school in Malaysia, and now I'm an editor again. And so as I've changed identities, you know, I went from being a single guy to now I'm married and now I have a kid. And, you know, as we look at identity, as I look at identity and discuss it with my wife, the idea that identity shifts. And from the perspective of the protagonist, of the commandant here, this is something he's dedicated his life to. And it folds. It's a significant loss, as it would be. And I think for a lot of us, you know, you look at an American industrial perspective, the steel workers in Youngstown, Ohio, and the mills shut down, or all the recent discussion, and I'm sure it's going to come up again, but about, you know, the place of the coal miner in American society. You know, those are institutions that gave people identities. And when they're gone, what do you replace that with? And I think I started thinking about that in 2009. You know, I came home from Afghanistan, and a month later, I was off active duty. And I went to Europe to go see my best friend from high school, who was a professor at the London School of Economics. And we did a quick jaunt, and we were in Portugal. Portugal was the world's dominant empire 400 years ago, right? Like, here's Portugal. And I'm sitting in Lisbon on a patio, having green wine and salted cod, and looking around at this collapsed empire, and how they were at the apex, and now they're not. And you know, it's 2009. I've spent 8 months in Iraq. I've spent 6 months in Afghanistan. I haven't fully processed or figured out what I'm doing, or what I was doing there, or what we were doing, spending the nation's treasure, its lives, its prestige. And I started processing what the end of an American empire, and we don't call ourselves an empire, but what the end of the American reign looks like. And the timeline I had roughly given, totally unscientific and probably after the second bottle of green wine, was about 100 years. So we've got another 100 years tops. And I think as, you know, I wrote this in, you know, now 10 years after that event, we're hard at work threatening our allies. We're hard at work threatening NATO. We're threatening the Aussies. There's a segment of the American society that's embracing the darker tides of humanity. So what are our long-term choices of that act, or what are the long-term consequences of that active choice that we are making as a nation? And that allowed me to examine some of the institutional concepts of loss, things that I'd been kicking around for 10 years and had discussed, you know, probably over another bottle of green wine, but I hadn't been able in any way to formalize that, right? And so that's the institutional loss. The personal loss, this doesn't give anything away. There's, and I'm sure many of your listeners have seen them, you know, the metal bracelets that a lot of us wear. The commandant's wearing one in this story, and it's talking about his TBS roommate getting killed in Iraq. And that wasn't my TBS roommate, but that was, you know, that the lieutenant that is, and I don't name him in the story, but that's a guy named Josh Booth. That's Josh's bracelet. And I went to the first and second cycles of officer candidate school with Josh. He commissioned about 8-9 months ahead of me, and before I left the basic school, which is the 6-month lieutenant training academy we go to after commissioning, Josh was leading a rifle platoon in Iraq and was killed, leaving a wife and two kids. So that bracelet, right? That's the personal loss. That's Josh Booth, and it just as easily could be Nick Madraza, who was a kid from, who was another lieutenant in my platoon. It could have been, Gary Henry, who was a firefighter I worked with. Like, but when I was writing the story, it was Josh Booth. That personal loss, and I think there's a generation of us now, you know, and we've been at war for almost 18 years straight, that all have that metal bracelet with someone. We all know someone. And, you know, does leaving an organization mean you forget that person? No, but it shifts things and it makes it personal. Those are the personal, those are the institutional, and you've alluded to it. It's a story written post a major conflict, right? I don't talk about battle, but, you know, watching obviously a military defeat has to have happened, one would think, for this prompt. And, you know, looking at the American military right now, there's a huge dichotomy. You know, we've got more combat experience than we have in history, but we haven't won anything since 1991. What does that mean, right? And, you know, we keep saying we're the most powerful, we're the best. What does that actually mean? Yeah, I mean, you could look at it in terms of pure dollar, and dollar for dollar, we're spending more than anybody else. But, you know, are you busy? Are you busy accomplishing something? You know, and I'm thinking to Clausewitz here, right? Like, you know, what does victory mean? Is victory different today than it was for my grandfathers in the Pacific or my father in Vietnam? And I think Clausewitz would probably say it's not. You know, war is a continuation of politics by other means. So we spent all this money and all this, these lives and this national capital and treasure and prestige. You know, we've sent Josh Booth and Gary Henry and Nick Madrazo off, but to what end? And so that was, I think, probably foremost when I initially framed the idea for the story. And that's why loss is so, I mean, probably is the driving theme. If you were to put this in a high school short story class, that would be the theme you'd have to pull out for your essay.
I'm probably not going to put this in a high school short story class because I don't really go to high schools that often, but that's a good suggestion. So Tim, one of the interesting focuses is a uniform, a dress uniform that I mean, you mentioned two uniforms in the story. One is the Marine Corps dress blues, which most of my listeners, regardless of what nation they're from, probably recognize. They probably would recognize a dress uniform alpha, but they probably wouldn't know what it's called. So the alphas seem significant in your story. Why is this so?
So to give your listeners an idea of what the alphas are, right? It's a service uniform alpha, and the Marine Corps has more costume changes than a Freddie Mercury show. But the alphas, when people are thinking of what an alpha looks like, picture Ollie North testifying to Congress. That's what the alphas are, right? It's the
listeners might know who that is, so someone else.
Man, all right. Ollie North, Iran-Contra? No, yeah, I don't have a good description. It's the green. It's the closest thing to a business suit we have. It's a single-breasted blazer with ribbons, the green trousers, right? So anytime you see the commandant going to Congress, that's what he's wearing. Anytime you see videos of Iran-Contra, there's Ali North lying to Congress in his alphas. And they are this uniform item that everybody gets, right? You get issued at a boot camp, you have to buy it as an officer. You check into units in alphas. It is an iconic image, you know, and you nailed the dress blues, but it is the one that we it's the second iconic image of us. And it's one that Marines would identify with because it is that thing that you wear maybe every once a year, but, you know, woe be to the Marine whose body has changed since they were 19 and got fitted for it. So you check into units wearing them. Yeah, when I was in an artillery battalion, we did a battalion colors rededication. We all wore our alphas.
Yeah.
You know, it is used at important ceremony times when the dress blues are not quite right. And so when I was thinking about them and thinking about, you know, well, what would you wear to a change of command? You check in alphas. Why wouldn't you check out of the Marine Corps in them? And that's why I went with that. That's why I titled the story with that, because it's a touchstone that every Marine, regardless of rank, knows of and is aware. I just recently joined my reserve unit. I was in, you know, you spend 4 hours prepping the things and you're in them for about 3 minutes. The commander looks at you, goes, yeah, you're not too fat, go change. but, you know,
lucky
they are an important piece of who we are and what we do as an institution. And so I thought that was a good way to frame it.
And my next question, I guess my final question about the story, apart from the bonus question, listeners. So if you're not a Patreon supporter, you don't get to find out what the bonus question is. But my final question for all of our listeners, including the cheapskates, is why did you choose to focus on the commandant in this tale rather than, you know, a battle or, you know, the story of the common soldiers probably, or common Marines, probably the most popular. Why the Commandant?
Ooh. Well, yeah, I think, you know, ultimately it's a personal story. It is one man and his memories and the inherited institutional memories. You know, it's not the giver, right? He doesn't have all of society's memories in his head, but he's walking through effectively a house of ghosts at this point. I thought writing a battle story I'd have struggled with. I mentioned earlier, and I just go kind of at length, you know, writers like Vonnegut and Mailer and Heller, and not so much Mailer, but Vonnegut and Heller, there's not a lot of combat in their stuff.
No, I mean, you know, Vonnegut, barely any.
Right. You know, Billy Pilgrim gets captured. He meets a prisoner. But anyway,
he doesn't even fight.
That's fine. Fantastic. Read it. Amazing. Read it three times because you're not going to get it the first two.
Yeah.
And if you're me, you probably need to read it a few more.
Well, listen to James Franco. Read it in audiobook. It's pretty good.
Yeah. skip the movie. But the they're personal stories about people and which is probably the dumbest thing I've said today. But
well, yeah, as opposed to personal stories about dogs, like The Secret Life of Pets and Secret Life of Pets Too. Yeah, I get it.
I hang out with toddlers too much, Mick. That's not the first reference to that in the last 3 days. But you know, the Marine Corps is a personal identity. Being a Marine is an identity, and this is a guy who has. Who embodies the Marine Corps, right? He is the pinnacle of what we want of the organization. He's the pinnacle of the institution. You know, he's the first photo and the last guy in your chain of command before, you know, it gets up into civilian leadership. And he's the spokesperson. He's the representative. He's all of these things. And the commandant in this story would be a classmate of mine. He'd be a peer. You know, I mentioned Josh earlier, like it's not unreasonable that I, you know, in 2042, when the story is set, that I went to the basic school and officer candidate school or command and staff college with the then, you know, the future fictional commandant I've written about.
Yeah, but it's not you though.
No. They're not going to take a Chaco to do that. frankly, I don't want to wear my alphas that much. But by putting it in an institutional public figure, I could embody the entire Marine Corps in one character without having to write an extensive backstory. And thus allowing emotion and that sense of loss and the beginning of the process of grieving for the institutional loss to take place in the story form. You know, the prompt set in 2042. If the prompt was set in 2052, my commandant probably would have been a woman. I think that is coming, and that is super exciting. For me to see the Marine Corps grow and develop and adapt. But you know, it's a he in the story because in 2042, my prediction is the commandant will be a male infantry officer commissioned sometime between 2002 and 2010.
It's quite a limb you've gone out on with that prediction
there. Yeah, and I've probably given way too much of a bracket on the commissioning date, but certainly not going to be an arty guy. Largely because we can't hear, but nobody knows what we're saying, or we don't know what anybody else is saying either.
Now, Tim, we're gonna take a short break, which will be almost indistinguishable, or undetectable to our listeners, because well, it'll be detectable to our legends, who will actually go on to the next question. The other listeners will teleport straight to the final question. But right now, we'll do the bonus question. And Tim, thanks for such a riveting answer on the bonus question. We're going to quickly go to the final question now because, well, it's probably the most important question on the show. And my final question is one I ask of all guests. I don't always get a brief answer, but that's what we aim for. I blame Twitter going to 280 characters, but it relates to our mission on the war. It relates to our mission on the show to define war in as many ways as possible, just like Big Carl, the Depression himself, did, to continue the debate on war and its costs to society. Now, I ask each guest to finish the sentence, "War is." So, Tim, I ask you now, finish the sentence, "War is."
Perhaps the most surreal thing after parenthood.
Brilliant. Parenthood is war. That's what I heard then, ladies and gentlemen. And that is that's a great one. It's very interesting. You say that Kurt Vonnegut's one of your one of your influences. So a little bit of surrealism to explain war is quite interesting. Those of us that have benefited the opposite from some time serving in the wars of the recent past probably understand exactly what you mean by that, because it's also nice and succinct. Now, Tim, thank you very much for, one, writing alphas, two, submitting alphas, and three, agreeing to talk to me whilst whilst it's embargoed as the winning entry by the Krulak Center. But it's greatly appreciated that we could take some time to talk about using creative processes from people who may be called upon to fight future wars to explore future wars. Thanks very much for coming on the show, Tim.
Hey, Mick, my pleasure. Thank you kindly for having me.
Now, ladies and gentlemen, get along and read the story Alphas. I'm not sure where it's being published yet, but I will put up lots of links. If anyone is looking for an audiobook recording of it, let me know. And although an Australian accent reading a story about US Marine Corps, that's pretty unique. Make sure you give it a read and make sure you follow Tim and his writing and projects. The Amphibious Operations one is quite exciting. I almost sent in a chapter myself, but anyone who's had to edit or get me to stick to a deadline will know exactly what would have happened with that. So Tim on Twitter is at TGHEC1. So that's TGHECK numeral 1. Also, jump on all the socials and follow all of the Krulak Center's socials. They're absolutely fantastic. Got some great coins and merchandise, mugs rivaling our mugs, but a great bunch of people who do some great things for professional military education. And they don't just post pictures of their work. They also show you them working. So some really great photos of them workshopping things. It's absolutely brilliant. Now, also, you can subscribe as a legend on Patreon, as mentioned. It's a flat $5 fee. And what you get for that once a month is you pay us. We stay on the air. We can pay the bills. But we can also provide you bonus content like bonus questions in our episodes and other types of bonus content we're working on. But until next time, listeners, grab a book and crack on.
Join the conversation with us on Twitter at Dead Prussian Pod, on Facebook at The Dead Prussian Page, or on our website www.thedeadprussian.com. All show notes for this episode, as well as copyright information, can be found on the website. The Dead Prussian Podcast is written, produced and hosted by Mick Cook. It is co-produced by Amanda Levito. The music used throughout is Caught in the Beat by Broke for Free and is used under a Creative Commons Attribution License. All opinions expressed by individuals on the podcast are those of the individual and not necessarily representative of any other organisation.